Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Whale, CEO. This week's episode will feature on two very distinct perspectives from the front lines of war. We'll first hear my conversation with Admiral James Stavridis. He's Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts. We'll then hear from Sebastian Younger. He's an author, a filmmaker, and a combat journalist. Admiral Stavridis served in the U.S. Navy for 37 years. He was the Supreme Allied Commander for NATO, and he led NATO's operation in Libya. This broadcast was recorded in San Francisco and is made possible by the generous support of Chevron.
You know, a recurring theme in your remarks was this notion of both listening and seeing the point of view of an adversary or a competitor or even a friend. And we have several questions about North Korea, so let's just start there.
Sure.
I think you said that Kim Jong-un was unstable but not crazy.
Correct.
By that I take it to be mercurial but rational.
Exactly.
So what is his thinking? What are his goals? And what are his options? And does a response of sanctions, which seems rational to me, is it relevant at all?
His goals are, number one, to continue his life of power and prestige and to run his extraordinary dystopian world that has been created around him. He's a third generation dictator. We have not seen that in modern times before. And he was absolutely inculcated in that shark tank of a life. And so his number one goal is his self-preservation, that of his family and his cronies. Number two, his longer term goal is to dominate the Korean Peninsula. And he's been very clear about that. That's been the goal of North Korea for decades. And number three, he would like to gain respect on the stage of the world. With those three goals in mind, I think your question, Jane, is exactly right. Can sanctions influence it? I think they can. The one red line he has, in my view, is, unfortunately, his nuclear weapons. He has watched what happened to Gaddafi when he gave up nuclear weapons, what happened to Saddam Hussein when he gave up nuclear weapons, what happened to the nation of Ukraine when they gave up nuclear weapons. They're now occupied by Russian forces. He believes he has to hold on to those weapons because they fulfill all three of the objectives he has. So I think our best approach is going to be a combination of strong deterrence coupled with sanctions that eventually drag him to four-party or potentially six-party talks, four-party U.S., China, North Korea, South Korea, six-party, add Russia and Japan. Drag him to the table. I think the best we're going to be able to do without going to a war in North Korea is to freeze his nuclear program and specifically to freeze his intercontinental ballistic program. I think it is, unfortunately, unrealistic to believe we're going to find a way for him to give up those weapons peacefully. And I'll close, if I may, by saying we ought to look, speaking of the oceans, we ought to look at a naval blockade. Mm. Again, I'm suspicious of historical analogy, but if you look back to the Cuban Missile blockade, pretty effective, and it gave the initiative to the United States. It took it away from the Soviet Union. I think we need to gain the initiative here. That would be a way to couple with sanctions and drag him to the table and hopefully freeze the program at a place we can live with. I think there's a 70% chance that we will muddle through this without exchanging ordnance. I think there's a 20% chance we will have an exchange of ordnance, but it will be limited in character. He will shoot a weapon at Guam. We will take out a naval facility. He'll respond with artillery barrage, but not at highly populated areas in Seoul. We'll start to escalate, but not go to an extreme. Jane, I think there's a 10% chance this goes sideways and we have a significant war on the Korean Peninsula. And that is, I'd say, 500,000 to 1 million people minimum dead.
Yeah.
So this is a very deeply concerning scenario with a limited tool set and a limited group of good options. The ones I mentioned, I think, are our best bet.
Is being party to a nuclear arms control agreement something that would confer the kind of prestige he's looking for.
Yes. And I think he wants, again, respect. He wants a small number of nuclear weapons. I think if we can accommodate that, we can best steer our way through this without really having a significant level of casualties. It's not an attractive set of outcomes, but I think it's the best one we could foresee realistically.
So let me take you to Iran. Again, this is a region you know well, part of the world you know well. I guess just sort of starting with that, since we're talking about nuclear agreements, with that agreement, you know its merits and its demerits. What is your sense of the importance of that agreement from a pure arms control perspective, but also from a political perspective? What is the value in having forged an agreement with the moderate forces within Iran?
I opposed the agreement as it was being negotiated. I felt, in a tactical sense, it did not bind Iran sufficiently. And of course, at the end of 10 years, 15 years, we could debate it. They're free to develop nuclear weapons. However, I now believe it would be a mistake to try and unwind it. We've had the debate, good deal, bad deal. It's a done deal. And so the Europeans are now increasingly invested in business activity in Iran. They're not going to come with us, especially with the Trump administration. And so from where we sit today, you got to play the ball from where it is on the field. From this point forward, I'd say we got to keep it in place. We got to confront Iran regionally in Yemen, in Damascus, in Iraq. We ought to have the geopolitical competition that is unfolding, and we ought to play the long game, which is the forces of moderation in Iran. I think over the 10 to 20 year future, the theocracy will die out, and I think that's our best bet in Iran. We don't need another potential war in the Middle East, and cracking that agreement, I think, opens the door to that.
Talk a little more about Yemen.
Sure.
We have a role there. Tell us what.
Sure.
What is the long game?
Yeah.
How does it fit into
in
a long
Yemen?
Game?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in Yemen, you see a conflict between Sunni and Shia in the country, and with Iran supporting the Shia forces, and Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states on the side of the Sunni government. It's turning into and most importantly, a horrific humanitarian disaster with an attendant famine. A cholera epidemic is breaking out. The almost indiscriminate use of weapons by both sides are causing massive civilian casualties. And frankly, there's no end in sight. I think that the United States is, and I think this is appropriate, is working with the Saudi and the Gulf states, but trying to moderate the way in which they're conducting this campaign. But it is a good example of where we are going to have to confront Iran. Otherwise, they will sweep through Yemen, just as they are making significant gains in Damascus, in Lebanon, in Baghdad, and other places.
So let me take you to another place, though.
Sure.
We've got a question card on it, but also the president focused on Venezuela.
Sure.
In his remarks to the United Nations. Another part of the world you know well, from Southern Command.
Yeah.
We see in Venezuela both the collapse of a political system and an economy.
Right.
Things are going truly south.
Yeah.
What are our interests, and what is our potential positive influence?
Sure. Whenever you talk about the United States and Latin America and the Caribbean, and I'm from Miami, I speak Spanish, I have traveled extensively in that region, and I commanded all U.S. forces south of the United States for 3 years, so I know it reasonably well. Everywhere you go, Latin Americans, individuals in the Caribbean, that world, they remember the U.S. military as an instrument of intervention. Mm-hmm. And we don't really think of ourselves that way. You know, we kind of say, oh, yeah, it's an important part of the world. You know, that's America's backyard. Well, first of all, think about that expression and how that sounds, America's backyard. I mean, we're not Canada's backyard. And secondly, you need to know the history here. Sometimes I'll ask an audience, how many times do you think the United States has invaded a country in Latin America or the Caribbean in the last 150 years? And most audiences will say, well, you know, not that many, you know, Grenada, Mexican-American War, Spanish-American War, Cuba, you know, and they start adding it up, and they'll say, you know, I don't know, maybe 15 times, maybe 20 times. The correct answer, folks, is 77 times. We've invaded Mexico 11 times. We've invaded the Dominican Republic 6 times. Some of these are small. You know, we're in the Marines Memorial here. The Marines have a robust history in this part of the world. Often a company of Marines would take over the banking system in Nicaragua for a while. But an invasion is an invasion. It's the imposition of armed troops for political purpose in a sovereign state without the consent of that state. That's an invasion. We've done it 77 times. We don't remember that. You know, if the United States were a dog, which we're not, but if we were, we'd be a golden retriever. We'd be kind of bounding through the world, and our tail would knock things over, and we'd be a good-natured dog. But we'd be an annoying dog. And in Latin America and the Caribbean, they remember it. And this is a long way of saying how counterproductive it is for example, President Trump to muse about, well, we might have to intervene militarily in Venezuela. You know, for the Latin Americans, this is, oh my God. Mm-hmm. And so what we should be doing, Jane, is working with the Organization of American States, pushing Colombia and Brazil and Mexico to the front of this conversation. If we're going to put sanctions on, they ought to be highly targeted against the Maduro clack that are running the government. We need to be in the background and have our Latin American partners in the front. And the good news is they're ready to step up and do that, particularly President Juan Manuel Santos in Colombia, who won the Nobel Peace Prize last year, by the way, Fletcher graduate, for for negotiating the end of the 60-year insurgency. So there are very capable diplomats who can work this. We need to be supportive. We need perhaps targeted sanctions. We don't need to be talking about invasions. There is no U.S. military role in Venezuela, but it is the crisis flying under the radar. Mm-hmm. And I think actually the chances of a violent ending there are higher than they are in Korea. And that is very worrisome.
I'm going to take you back to Asia then, mm-hmm. and to your theme of seeing the world through their eyes. And that's China's view of its role sure. in the world. We've yeah. thought of it for a long time as not seeking to project power, mm-hmm. in fact, to tend to business at home. Yeah. Now it's, you know, it offers economic competition, oh. political competition, mm-hmm. and military mm-hmm. competition. How does it see its mm-hmm. own role?
Mm-hmm. Deng Xiaoping, and you'll know the story, but was asked how he felt about China's role. China sees itself not as a nation. They see themselves as a civilization. And Deng said to Kissinger, well, we've had a couple bad centuries, but we're coming back. China plays the long game in a way that we can't begin to comprehend. So China has spent the last 50 years, starting and stopping, but essentially lifting people out of poverty. They've done a very credible job. They've probably lifted close to 1 billion people out of poverty and extreme poverty under UN definitions. They are now ready to begin a more expansive role in the world. President Xi went to Davos and gave the most globalized speech about the yeah. Silk Road, the belt and suspenders, all of China's economic movement. On the military front, China claims the South China Sea. And that is a preposterous claim under international law. But they believe they own it. Why? Because of Admiral Zheng He, because they have been there forever. They say it's a historical claim. What they really want, Jane, are the hydrocarbons. That is the one missing piece of China's strategic suite in the 21st century is a lack of hydrocarbons. They exist under the South China Sea.
Yeah.
So China will push into that zone. And as I pointed out, China's Navy is now operating globally. They work more and more with the Russian Navy, and together that's a pretty formidable force. They have just built their first overseas military base in the Horn of Africa. Now, you know, the United States has 100 overseas bases. We're a global power, but we need to recognize the fact that China is rising.
Has it moved? Is it moving away from a minimum deterrent in its nuclear program?
I think the nuclear strategic deterrent with China is sufficient and in an appropriate place. Where I think we are in a wild west with China is in cyber. And here we see Chinese activity both in terms of theft of intellectual property, of traditional espionage, but increasingly finding and probing into our infrastructure. That, I think, is the most worrisome trade space we have with China, along with the disagreement about the South China Sea. Let me tell you what I think we should do about it geopolitically. We should get closer to India. In 200 years, a historian's going to write a history of the 21st century. It's not going to be about the rise of China. It'll be about the rise of India because of demographics, because it's a democracy, because it has English as an elite language that connects it to the world. India, for all of its challenges with corruption and infrastructure and a thousand other things, I'd bet on this century on India. So a way to think of this is U.S., European Union, our value set, our democracy, China rising. 21st century is about India. Where does India end up aligned? We would be very smart to be working to move India here. That's how we can balance geopolitically. That's how we balance China. It doesn't mean we're going to war, but it means we're creating a network of alliances.
And in the last 20 years, we have been moving in that direction.
We have indeed, and I applaud that by the Bush administration, by the Clinton administration, and I hope we'll see that continue. By the way, with Ambassador Nikki Haley, who is Indian-American.
And doing a fabulous job.
My pick for the top official in the Trump administration, full stop, and I love Jim Mattis. I think Nikki Haley, with a really lousy hand of cards, in the United Nations, is punching way above her weight.
In your book, Destroy Our Captain.
Oh, that's going back a ways.
You talk about, if you write 11 books, you know, you describe your paternal grandfather as having come over from Turkey as a result of the ethnic cleansing there.
Refugee.
Come over as a refugee to this country. Ended up having a grandson in this extraordinary role. I wonder, as you think about that and you think about his contribution to this country, and you look at this horrible, disastrous situation with over 60 million refugees around the world or migrants around the world, but particularly right now spilling out of out of Syria, a lot of them women and children. We're saying we don't want to take them.
And we are failing.
What should we be doing?
We should hold our values. And that is both morally correct and it's pragmatically correct. When I talk to my German friends who have took in 1 million refugees from Syria on a population of 80 million, population adjusted, that would be like the United States taking 3.5 million refugees. That's what the Germans did. We would be taking 3.5 million to meet their commitment. We've taken 6,000. We're failing, and there's a pragmatic component. In Germany, these refugees will come, and the first generation will open shawarma shops and small businesses. The second generation will go to university. The third generation will be CEOs of big companies. And we know that because we've watched that generation after generation in the United States of America. There's a pragmatic component here, and there's a moral component, and we are missing the boat. And I'll give you the pragmatic component one more round, which is to say, think about a young father in Syria who takes the hand of his three-year-old son, puts his one-year-old in a backpack, and he and his wife walk across Turkey. They get in a boat. They make it to Germany. I want that person on my team. How much courage does that take? How much determination? How much endurance? Germany will trade up with the vast majority. Will there be a few terrorists? Will there be a few bad people? You bet. But at the end of the day, there'll be a pragmatic upside and there'll be a moral upside to doing this. And if I could, I'll close, because I know we're almost out of time, with the last sea story about my grandfather. And it's this. In 1922, the city of Smyrna, it's called Izmir today, in western Turkey, was burned as part of a war between Greece and Turkey. But it was burned by the Turkish army, and the Armenian and Greek communities, many of them, were massacred. My grandparents were very lucky. They stood on a quay wall and watched the city burn behind them in 1922. They were rescued by Greek fishermen, brought to Athens, and then took ship to the United States of America, 1922. 1992, their grandson, me, I went back to that quay wall, and I pulled up in my billion-dollar U.S. warship, of which I was the captain. And the Turkish liaison officer came aboard, and he said, "Captain Stavridis, Stavridis, is that a Greek name?" I said, "Actually, my grandparents were citizens of the Ottoman Empire until they were invited to leave." And I think we need to remember both the compassionate and the pragmatic reasons in so many cases for these refugees. We don't hear that side of the conversation often enough, Jane.
So one last question, and sure. That is that you were rumored to be considered to be the running mate of Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
And her presidential campaign, and then rumored to be Donald Trump's choice for Secretary of State. If you had taken one of those jobs.
Yeah.
And you still had in mind your desire to have all your Fletcher graduates go into government service. What kind of model would you want to put forth, and how would you do it? How would you signal that this is an honorable thing to do?
Mm-hmm. First of all, those aren't rumors. Those are both true statements. I was vetted for vice president by Hillary Clinton. She ultimately selected Tim Kaine. Good choice, good man, I know him well. If Secretary Clinton had asked me to go into government to serve as national security advisor, I would have done so. President-elect at the time, Trump, asked me to Trump Tower. I rode the golden elevator. I spent an hour and a half with him. And at the end of that, he offered me a cabinet position as director of national intelligence. He did not. His chief of staff did. I declined it because I had significant policy disagreement with the Trump administration. But to answer your question, I would hope that those who want to serve are centrists, are balanced, are respectful of others, listen more than they speak, have real intellectual capital, own our values, have a sense of humor and a sense of humility. And that's what we try and convey to our Fletcher students as we encourage them to serve their country in some capacity.
You make us all want to go back to school. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
Jane. This was wonderful.
It was a pleasure. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We've been listening to my conversation with Admiral James Stavridis. He's dean of the Fletcher School at Tufts University. And we'll now turn to my conversation with Sebastian Younger. He's an author, a filmmaker, and a combat journalist. In his newest film, Hell on Earth, The Fall of Syria and the Rise of ISIS, he documents the Syrian civil war through the stories of ordinary Syrians. These are folks who struggle to survive the chaos of war and the subsequent rise of extremism. And now on to our conversation.
Welcome to World Affairs. This is the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're in San Francisco. We're at Marines Memorial Association having a conversation with Sebastian Younger. He is the author of The Perfect Storm, of a book called Tribe, in which he focuses in part on the experience of veterans when they return home, in part for that. And of course, and a book entitled War. He has produced at least two documentary films, one of them Restrepo, and the other one, which we'll talk a lot about today, is Hell on Earth, The Fall of Syria and the Rise of ISIS. I wanted to start, Sebastian, though, with your own motivations, because you have reported from Bosnia, you've gone into Afghanistan for a period of time. This most recent documentary is on Syria. You've referred to war and crisis as a source of meaning. Say something, but what does that mean for you?
I think humans feel that there's great meaning afoot when the consequences of something are large. That gives us a sense of meaning. When you can make choices that have no consequence in your life or in other people's lives, it doesn't feel as meaningful. So a game of golf might be enormously pleasurable, but I would argue it's not meaningful in that way. And so what happens in war is that everything becomes meaningful because everything potentially has consequences. I mean, I know for a fact that on a certain day 10 years ago, almost exactly 10 years ago, I was leaning against a HESCO, leaning against some sandbags at OP Restrepo on a quiet September, hot September day. And had I been leaning two or three inches more to the left, I'd be dead. And a bullet hit the sandbag. The first round of the first burst of an hour-long firefight hit the sandbag right next to my head, close enough to kick dirt into my face, sand into my face. So even where you stand, where you lean, can be a matter of life and death. And that gives life a kind of unearthly glow. And once you experience that, it's quite hard to give it up.
You've written about the experience of a warrior, the experience of a soldier, a Marine, an airman, a sailor, coming home from war and feeling a sense of loss. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, first of all, you're giving up this anguishing sense of meaning, an intoxicating sense of meaning, when you leave a war zone and come home. But more importantly, at least for the American soldiers that I was with in Afghanistan, combat is conducted in platoons of soldiers, 30, 40, 50 people. Anthropologists will tell you that's roughly the size of the living group, the typical living group for our human ancestors for the last hundreds of thousands of years. We are wired to function and to care deeply about groups of 30, 40, 50 people, to sleep shoulder to shoulder with them, hunt, defend ourselves with them, go through hardships together, dangers together, joys together. That's what we're wired for. And so when you have soldiers who experience that in combat, or even in a rear base, in a support unit, even that, it will even happen with that. When they experience the intense communalism of a life in a platoon, when you take them out of that evolutionary true spot, and you pick them up and you drop them back down in modern society, all of a sudden they're an individual. They're not surrounded by a group 24/7. Soldiers get their sense of safety, physical safety, and by extension, emotional safety from the proximity of others. If you're alone on the battlefield, you are in a lot of trouble. For that matter, if you're alone in the wilderness, you're in a lot of trouble. Humans don't do well by themselves. They do very well in groups. So you're taking soldiers from that communal environment to a very isolating modern environment, and they miss it. They miss the war because they miss being in that kind of primordial human group. You don't have to even be traumatized. Volunteers for the Peace Corps, when they come home, around a quarter of them sink into a significant depression when they come back because they are no longer in the communal setting of a small village in a developing country. It's part of our human heritage. We're a social species. We're wired to live that way. And that makes coming home to an affluent, wealthy, modern society psychologically very, very difficult.
And that would be particularly the case in an instance when the war itself is unpopular. And so you don't come back to that, to the hero's welcome you may deserve.
I think that is a sort of layer that just adds a little bit of extra sort of bit of anguish, but I think you can come back from wars that had enormous support by the population and still feel like, my God, I don't belong in this society. Yeah. I belong with my guys. What am I doing? I'm not safe. I'm my family and I are in a house by ourselves. We're not safe, you know? And that sort of single family unit, the person alone in their apartment, like did not evolve to live that way. We don't feel safe that way. And when soldiers experience group living and come back to that, it's very, very difficult. And we know, psychologists will tell you, as affluence rises in society, the suicide rate goes up. The depression rate goes up. The PTSD rate goes up. There was an amazing study comparing Nigeria to North America. They studied women in urban and rural environments in both countries. And women in urban North America, the wealthiest group of the study, had the highest rates of depression. The people with the lowest rates of depression were in rural Nigeria, who were the poorest people. So poverty, along with enormous stresses, does enforce a collaborative existence that psychologically is very, very buffering for mental health problems.
So we started by talking about the experience of the combatant. Let's talk about the non-combatant, yeah. as you do in this film, where you focus on the refugees, in particular from Syria. Just give us a sense of the scope of the problem. We've got like 65 million people displaced, driven from their homes around the world. To what extent is this a sort of a combination of Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan? What about Africa? Yeah. Where are we seeing these refugee flows?
Right. I mean, where do you draw the line? If it's just war refugee, I mean, the number changes every month, every week, so I don't even know what the current tally is. It's millions and millions of people have been displaced just from Syria. And there's wars all over the Middle East, all over the world. It's the sort of displaced war refugee story is the stand, you know, is a journalistic standard. I mean, it just comes up every few months, every year. There's some Burma right now. I mean, there's always a new crisis where some group of unfortunates is being pushed out or are fleeing. So what does this do? Most immediately, it destabilizes the surrounding countries that these people spill into. And let me just say again, we should not blame them for fleeing, right? This is not some moral failure on their part. They're doing exactly what any of us would do in that circumstance. They're fleeing to protect their families, to preserve their futures, something any of us would do in those circumstances. So they're spilling into neighboring countries, destabilizing them. In addition, people who languish in refugee camps long enough, they don't get an education.
Right.
You know, they are vulnerable to poor thinking. They're vulnerable specifically in this case to a sort of jihadist inculcation. You really don't want young people languishing in refugee camps without an education for too many years, because you're creating a whole other crop of completely disenfranchised people who think the world has abandoned them, and it has. And along comes someone who says, you know what, you can right this wrong, you just need a little courage in your heart, you need to believe in your religion, and we can make this right. You don't want to create people like that. So I do understand the kind of hard-nosed, look, it's their problem, not our problem, why does America have to keep paying for everything? I mean, I totally get it. I think you can make a moral argument for wealthy countries, including ours, to take care of the suffering in the world. I mean, I think you can make just a moral argument, but let's not even do that. Let's just make a practical argument. We want to do everything we can to make sure that that kind of extremist thought is minimized, does not have a chance to take root. My experiences in Afghanistan started in 96. I remember being told when I was there, and just right when the Taliban were taking over Kabul, I got shot at by the Taliban on the outskirts of Kabul in the summer of 96. I was told by a Pashtun in Kabul, you know, we don't like these people. They're too extreme, they're horrible, but we're gonna let them take over Afghanistan because the civil war has got to stop. The corruption just has overrun our government. Like, we need help. And the Taliban, as awful as they are, they will straighten this country out. The reason that was happening is because the United States fight a proxy war with the Soviets, filled Afghanistan up with arms for a whole decade, right? It worked, right? The Soviets got really beat up in Afghanistan. It was part of what led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. We won that round, right? They pulled out, the Soviets pulled out in 89. And what did we do? We pulled out. We didn't continue a level of assistance, the same level of assistance that we did with weapons, with school books for children, rebuilding schools, rebuilding bridges, bringing in some help with forming a new government. We didn't do any of that. We just left. And as a result, we got a failed state for 10 years that eventually produced 9/11, and we don't want another 9/11. So the self-protective, the self-interested argument for involvement in these crisis spots in the world is that when you leave them to languish, the Somalias of the world, the Afghanistans of the world, the Syrias of the world, they produce a huge amount of human suffering and a really virulent strain of extremism that may reach us, and it did on 9/11.
Let me take you to the particulars of Syria. These refugees, and 4 million at first, I think it's closer to 5 million now, have spilled over into the frontline states, into Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon. What is their experience there? Some of them are living within communities, and some are in camps. Talk about the experience they have there, and why do they then, some portion of them, choose to move on, take a very treacherous journey to Europe?
It's hard to generalize. There's the entire spectrum of experiences for these people. The Marwan and Radwan, the two gentlemen that you saw in this film, and their families, I found them extraordinarily articulate and ethical, like really beautiful families. I mean, really, like, these are beautiful people. I mean, one of them was a garage mechanic. I mean, they seem very educated. They're really not. They're just ordinary people. But clearly very smart and pretty switched on and resourceful. And so they made it to Turkey. They tried to get to Greece. I mean, the dream for everybody is to get to the West, right? We're wealthy. We're peaceful. This is the dream for everyone, is to get, there's jobs, there's education. I mean, if you're from a developing country and you look at Canada or America or Europe, of course you want to go there. I mean, even if you don't want to, you want your kids to be there so they'll have a future. So people just want to come here for the same reason that we like being here. It's all the same, right? So those two families wanted to get to Europe. They didn't want to leave Syria. They loved Syria, right? But they realized that in Syria, they were going to get killed. In Turkey, they were going to languish. But if we can get to Germany, then we can give our children a future. A completely understandable, admirable way of thinking, right? They didn't make it. They got turned back by the Turkish Coast Guard. But they're smart, resourceful people, and they had a little bit of money saved up, and they started a business in Turkey. And now they're doing really, really well. And their hope is that when they've saved enough money and when the war has settled down and they can go back to where they're from, they're going to go back as soon as they can. Like, they want to go home. Just like you, anyone in this room would want to go home, they want to go home. I know my father, I mean, I don't even want to put his experience and their experience in the same sentence, but he was a refugee. He missed Europe terribly, and we lived there for a while. I mean, that's one of the things about refugees, is like, part of them really doesn't want to be here because they miss home. And so I think we have to sort of understand them on that level. But they were fortunate, right? There are a lot of people stuck in refugee camps in Jordan where they can't leave. They're stuck. They're in internment camps, basically.
Well, and isn't the key in those three countries is the question of whether they can absorb the school children right, and give them education, and whether you can have a livelihood there because you may be taking a job from someone in the host country. Are those the two motivators that you've referred to livelihoods, you've referred to education? Are those the two drivers?
Safety. I mean,
To Europe.
Yeah, I mean to have a future. Yeah. You know, and it's sort of understandable. Like, Jordan is like, listen, these refugees ultimately are the world's problem. Why do we have to solve the world's problem? And I sort of understand that. And that's where I think we really need the United States, we the world, like we really need a integrated, global, comprehensive solution to, you know, capital letters, the immigration crisis, the refugee crisis. The world should do something to help people that are fleeing for their lives, either for economic reasons or for because of war. And the burden should be spread around the world. We, the United States, shouldn't have to absorb it all. And neither should Jordan. I mean, it really needs, like the Paris Climate Accord, I mean, it really needs it's a global problem that needs a global solution. And until we talk about it like that, poor countries like Jordan or Turkey or whatever, they're going to be like, listen, we'll do what we can, but after that, they're going to be stuck in camps because we can't absorb them.
What's wonderful about documentaries is you bring it down to the individual. You can see the problem in terms of the individual. So let's talk a little bit about, is it Radwan is the name?
There's Marwan and Radwan, yes,
Radwan.
The two, yeah.
Obviously, his greatest desire is to get out of Syria with his children and wife, to bring them to safety. Tell us about his experiences with smugglers and his route.
So understand also that the decision, if you're in ISIS territory, really in any war zone, the decision to leave your home is incredibly perilous one. I mean, it's an extremely dangerous thing to do. So when you think about these people, think about the fact that they tried every possible option before they decided to flee. That they fled because if they stayed, they would die. And if they flee, they will probably die, but they might make it. That is the calculation that people like the ones in this film are making. it is not, oh, great, a free ride to the West. Like this, it is absolutely terrifying. I mean, imagine, just imagine what it'd be like to be hiding in the back of a pickup truck. I mean, I'm sure most of the people in the room have families. Imagine being with your family in the back of a pickup truck, covered by a tarpaulin, hoping to get through an ISIS checkpoint without them looking under the tarpaulin. And if they do and they find you, you'll all be shot. I mean, imagine how scary that is. That's the decision that they had to make. And that shows you how dangerous it was to stay where they were, that they were willing to do that. Thank God they made it. It cost them, I don't know exactly how much, but it cost them thousands and thousands of dollars. They had to pay bribes all the way through. The smuggler was incredibly expensive. Bribes all the way through Turkey. Then they had to pay smugglers to try to get them to Greece. You know, I'm guessing 10 grand. And this, the guy was a garage mechanic in Syria. Like that 10 grand is a lot of money. And they scraped and they managed to do it.
One of the first things that he does when he gets to Turkey is shave his beard. Yeah. Why? What did that mean for him?
ISIS, like the Taliban, insisted on that the men don't shave, and you could be whipped if your beard wasn't long enough, and all kinds of abusive stuff. So, shaving his beard was his way of saying, "All right, we're back in the land of true Islam." Is what I believe what he said. Islam does not insist that you grow a beard. That's some sort of freakish idea that extremists came up with, but really Islam doesn't care if you have a beard or not. And it matters, you know, not what's on your chin, it matters what's in your heart. So yeah, it was a very symbolic. And you know, keep in mind, we didn't shoot this, right? Like Nick shot them a little bit in Turkey once they got to Turkey. But a lot of these scenes, you know, we couldn't get in there, right? So we got them funds so that they could get themselves a camera in ISIS territory. And they documented themselves. I mean, they self-documented. I mean, all that incredible footage. I mean, some ways, some of the most powerful shots of the film. And we had a bunch of professionals, you know, working for us in northern Iraq. Some of the most powerful shots of the film were shot by those guys on a Samsung 7. So my point is that they weren't performing for a journalist when they went to the barbershop. This was a spontaneous, heartfelt, like, all right, now, you know, like, now we're free of you idiots.
It's the exercise of free choice.
Yeah, exactly. And freedom of religion, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All of this because of a war that started, in the film you talk about two boys having been tortured, or two teenage boys, and that being at the crux of it.
I'm lucky to have an extremely brilliant childhood friend named Sarah Shays. She's at the Carnegie Institute right now. She was an NPR reporter for a long time. She, in 2001, she drove into Kandahar on a motorcycle. She's a Harvard grad, she's all kinds of things. But she drove into Kandahar on a motorcycle right after 9/11. I mean, the Taliban were still in power, and rented a house and started making herself a sort of world citizen of Kandahar to see what she could do. And she started a business, a soap making business, and taught the Afghans how to manufacture sort of boutique soap, and it's now sold all over the world. Because she really speaks Pashtun, she's the only woman in Kandahar driving a truck, she's had to flee. She came up with this theory that she started to notice that all of these really radical Islamic movements were born in situations of civil war that were started in part over the issue of corruption. People in that part of the world, many parts of the world, revolt over financial abuse wrought by criminal cartel governments on the populace. The Taliban came into power because the Afghan government that was left behind after the Soviets pulled out was so unbelievably corrupt. It was a criminal cartel. Somalia, ditto. Syria, Nigeria with Boko Haram, all ghastly movements. They got traction with the population because they would come in and say, the corrupt criminals that are running your country and supported by Western countries, like, we're gonna get rid of them. We are gonna bring a fair system to your society so you don't have to pay bribes to policemen. You can actually make a living. So perfectly decent people will welcome in absolutely awful organizations because corruption is an incredibly toxic thing to experience and destroys countries. If you want to stop terrorism, focus on corruption in the world. Stop corruption. That's how it gets its start. That's what gets people to say, you know what, we don't like the Taliban very much, but we're going to let them in. All these radical movements promise an end to corruption. Beat them to it. Force governments that we're allied with to stop corruption, and you really pull the rug out from under some of these movements. And so in Syria, the initial protests were about government corruption, which was just, you know, epidemic proportions in Syria, like every other country over there. Those protests were put down violently, and then that violence was protested, and those protests were put down violently, and pretty soon you have people, good people, regular people, ordinary people, getting their hands on guns so they're not just mowed down by soldiers in the street. And then you let that go on for a little while, and pretty soon you have yourself a civil war. I mean, that's how it started.
But this is a case, if you put yourself in the head of Bashar al-Assad, he was facing a potential reformist movement.
Yeah. Right?
And given the choice between that and war, he seems to have chosen the latter. That is to say, he cracked down with full force. Yep. This was not dealt with as a civil problem.
I mean, once the killing starts, it's very hard. It's a ratchet. It's very hard to walk it back. I don't know what would have happened if he had said, I mean, one of the people we interview for the film said, had he really embarked on real democratic reforms the way the protesters were asking, I mean, the government was completely corrupt. He would have been ousted and possibly charged and jailed. So Assad...
So that's his calculation.
That's his calculation. Assad made a rational choice to preserve his power and his personal safety. So, I mean, I wish he hadn't, but I sort of understand the thinking. He also had Iran and Russia behind him. You're not going to topple anyone with those two behind them. So, you know, I think one thing that can happen, you know, in the interests of, again, human suffering, I think you don't want to put justice ahead of human suffering. I think human suffering is the most important thing. Justice comes after that. I don't think you want to pursue, you have to be careful implacably pursuing justice in a situation where the leader, the dictator, realizes that it's either fight or go to prison, because they will fight, of course. So I think one thing that might help some of these situations is if the world figures out a way to work a deal with these people. Like, if you will step down or agree to democratic reforms, we will give you asylum in a nearby country. You do not have to spend your life in jail, but you also don't have to go to war. We'll take care of you and your family. You can live out your life in Turkey or whatever, or Iran. But you have to leave power. I mean, that something like that early on might work. Once the killing starts, it's very, very hard to walk it back.
One of the questioners asks about the appeal of ISIS. And here I'm going to take you back to talking about a sense of belonging in war. Is that part of the appeal of terror groups, is giving a sense of belonging, a sense of purpose, no matter how distorted, more how horrifying, but is that what part of the appeal is?
I mean, okay, so there's a whole range of appeals. Like, if ISIS rolls into your town in a convoy, 100 pickup trucks long, part of the appeal of ISIS is that if you don't join them, they'll kill you, right? So there's the sort of coercive end. All the way on up to, why would a middle-class kid in England or in France see ISIS in social media and online media and decide, oh, that, I want to be part of that. Like, these are normal kids, right, that are joining ISIS. This is not, I blanked on his name, in Vegas, the killer in Vegas. Yeah. He was a deranged person, obviously, right? These people joining ISIS are not deranged, right? I mean, some of them are. But you have to understand the appeal of ISIS in sort of normal human terms. And the people, the kids in Europe that are joining ISIS, they're not desperately poor either, right? I mean, these are middle-class kids. They're second-generation, third-generation kids. I hope I can remember this correctly. There's a wonderful band called Queens of the Stone Age, and they have a song, and the lyrics, one of the lyrics goes something like, I want something to die for to make it beautiful to live. There's really quite a profound insight into what motivates people. A lot of people's lives feel meaningless, feel empty, feel like without purpose, like they're just going through the motions. They're in school, they have a job, they're whatever. They're not affecting the world and they're not acting with belief, right? If you're willing to risk your life because you believe in something, you're really living. In a very profound human way, you're really living. And I think some of the sort of malaise and discontent in sort of middle-class European society gives rise to young people thinking, wow, ISIS, it's a community. It's portrayed online as a kind of social utopia. If I go over there, I'll belong to it. I'll be doing something meaningful or I'll die heroically. I mean, you know, these are 17, 18-year-olds, right? I mean, they're prone to all kinds of romantic thinking. And then they're over there, and of course, a few of them, you know, one in a thousand is a sociopath, like in any population, you know. But I think most of them, we've interviewed some of them, just shocked at the reality and desperate to get out. And in the full-length film, we interview someone who speaks very eloquently about what a lie the whole thing is. And he was very lucky to get out, and he gave us an amazing interview.
One of the things that experts in terrorism wrestle with is the difference in appeal between Al-Qaeda on the one hand and ISIS on the other. ISIS having a much more dramatic pull.
Yeah.
Now, part of this, you could say, is that they're standing on the shoulders of Al-Qaeda in the sense that they're,
yeah.
Right, some of the work has been done. But ISIS also offered a homeland, which is a pretty powerful force.
Yeah, I mean, the strength of terrorist networks is that they're networks, and they don't necessarily exist in any time and place. There are interlocking affiliations between people and groups. ISIS established territorial control. They could legitimately say, this spot on the map, this is the capital of the caliphate, and this area on the map, this is ISIS territory. And that gave them a kind of street cred that Al-Qaeda couldn't hope to compete with. Al-Qaeda controlled territory in Afghanistan, around Kandahar, during the reign of the Taliban. I think one of the reasons the Taliban didn't hand those guys over is because they didn't have the military capability to do it after 9/11. When, I don't know if you remember, President Bush said, hand them over, and we'll come in and help your country. If you don't hand them over, we're going to come in and get them. I think one of the reasons the Taliban didn't hand them over is because they couldn't. But I'm guessing. I don't know. But so ISIS holding territory is that's an incredibly powerful message, and it really is a kind of middle finger to the Western European establishment that thinks that they control the world. Like, no, you don't. We control a chunk of it that's, 10 times the size of Britain or whatever. What are you going to do about it?
But now that control is gone.
Yeah.
It strikes me that some of the lessons of your remarks, but also of your movie, is that you have to have a sense of the long game. You have to have a sense of, and then what?
Yeah.
So I want to take you to just one final theme, and then we'll thank you for this time. But you began with talking about the sense of brotherhood combatants have in war. And we went on and talked a little bit about the sense of brotherhood that those who are attracted to extremist groups, even terrorist groups, have. As you look at us right now as a society, would we benefit from a stronger sense of brotherhood at this moment?
Obviously, I'm going to say yes. Humans belong in groups. We evolved for groups. Right now, we in America are attempting this incredible experiment, very noble experiment, to see if we can live in a fair and equitable and just group of 300 plus million people. It's never been done before in human history, and we're doing it in a fashion. One of the problems with modernity is it allows people, I mean, the poorer the society, the more collaborative people have to be. There's upsides and downsides to that. At the hunter-gatherer level, there is very little evidence of suicide, of depression, apparently very little PTSD. The wealthier you get in a society, because people live more individualized lives and there's more economic inequality, the more at risk people are of suicide and depression and everything else. That's the irony of wealth, right? We're living in a country of 300 million. A disaster, a crisis would bring us together immediately, right? In 9/11, after 9/11 in New York City, the suicide rate went down. The murder rate went down. Violent crime went down, right? People act well. People are at their best in the worst circumstances. They're at their worst in the best circumstances. And we, as a wealthy modern country, have created the best circumstances. Some pretty bad behaviors come out. The Wall Street crash of 2008, I mean, the behavior of those people that bankrupted this country and cost us $14 trillion, bad behavior, right? Mass shootings, what is that? There's a lot of countries, every country in the world has crazy people in it. And there's a lot of countries with more guns and fewer gun controls than we have. And we are the only country that does this to ourselves. What is going on? I think the short version of the political partisanship in Washington, I mean, the short version, the short answer to all of those ills is that we are not a unified country. And we do that proactively. It's, you know, it's not because we're not religious enough. It's not because we're not patriots. It's none of that, right? We do not go out of our way to think of ourselves as a unity. I think national service, I don't think it's moral to force someone to fight a war they don't believe in, but it's entirely moral to insist that people contribute to their country for a year or two. That would create a unity. We need more people voting. We need less gerrymandering. We need an active ethos in Washington where politicians that speak with derision and contempt for their political opponents, that they be roundly criticized by their own political party. We need a culture like that in Washington. I'm talking about both the Democrats and the Republicans. We need to do that. And that will create a unity of 300 plus million that I think will that unity, I think, trickles down and will affect every town, every neighborhood, every individual in some way. But it is sick at the top, and it's making everyone else sick.
A lot of people talk about the trickle up, which may be the solution from communities.
Yes.
Please join me in thanking Sebastian Younger.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit organization dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Admiral James Stravitis, he's Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, and Sebastian Younger, author, filmmaker, and combat journalist. World Affairs invites you to join our globally minded community. And if you join us by the end of the year, new members will receive 14 months of membership for the price of a 1-year membership. Please contact our membership department at worldaffairs.org. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.